From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And what do we know about the first criminal charges to come from FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of possible Trump campaign ties to Russia? Today, former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort and his business associate and deputy on the campaign, Rick Gates, were charged with 12 counts, including conspiracy, money laundering, and making false statements about tens of millions of dollars Manafort earned as a lobbyist in Ukraine when he consulted for the Russian-backed president there. Manafort and Gates turned themselves into the FBI this morning. Unsealed records revealed a third person, former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos, pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his meeting with Russians. Carrie Johnson is NPR's Justice Department correspondent. She has been busy today reading these indictments. Carrie, just overall, how big a moment is this?
It's a big moment, just 5 months or so into the investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his team of about 16 lawyers and additional FBI agents. We have criminal charges unveiled today against three people, including a guilty plea from a man described as a foreign policy advisor to President Donald Trump's campaign last year, George Papadopoulos. Papadopoulos had acknowledged that he lied to the FBI about the nature and extent of his contacts with Russians and people close to Russia in the course of last year's campaign.
Yeah, these were documents that were actually unsealed today that show that he had already been arrested and pled guilty earlier this month. And let's start there briefly. This was about a meeting that he had with Russians.
A series of contacts. Papadopoulos at the time last year was based in London. The federal court papers suggest he had a meeting with a professor in London who had close ties to the Russian government, and then also a series of linkages with a woman at different points was described as a niece or a relative of Vladimir Putin. It turns out, according to the U.S. government, she was not actually Putin's niece, but instead somebody with close ties to the Russian foreign ministry. There were lots of ongoing dialogue about forging better ties between the U.S. and Russia, according to court papers. And Papadopoulos wanted to facilitate a meeting between people in Russia, high levels of the Russian government, and high levels of Donald Trump's presidential campaign in the course of last year's election.
Okay, and he has pled guilty to those charges. Go to Paul Manafort. The indictment accuses this former campaign chair of laundering more than $18 million. Now, before the Trump campaign, Manafort was a consultant with the then Russian-backed president of Ukraine, who was toppled. Manafort was fired from the Trump campaign when news came out about these undisclosed payments, up to $12 million, that he received for that work in Ukraine. So what does this indictment say? Is there a sense that this is money that he was paid and wanted to get into the country, you know, untaxed? Or was he squirreling out money for the toppled Russian-backed president of Ukraine?
Some tough words in this grand jury indictment, 31-page grand jury indictment about Paul Manafort, accusing him of creating a series of offshore bank accounts to funnel $75 million in earnings or proceeds from his lobbying efforts, then failing to report that to the FBI, the IRS, or the Justice Department as an unregistered foreign agent. In fact, Robin, the sense is that, according to this indictment, that Manafort wanted to fund his lavish lifestyle by cheating, by not paying taxes. And the court filings suggest he paid for landscaping at properties in the Hamptons, paid for a BMW, paid for a Rolls Royce, clothing at a boutique in Beverly Hills. Mm. A lot of allegations that would look kind of bad in front of a jury if a jury eventually hears this case.
Well, you know, not paying your taxes, that's one thing. But is there a sense that this was, you know, just the money that he was paid for the work he did, $18 million or $12 million? Or is there a sense that he was also working, you know, with a Russian-backed, toppled president to get money out of Ukraine?
The court papers don't dwell on the Russian ties or Russian allegations. The court papers, the indictment is quite clear that it relates to money laundering and a series of failures by Manafort and his right-hand man, Rick Gates, to disclose the source of funds and failures to disclose their lobbying. In fact, the DOJ says that over the course of last year, starting in September, Manafort and Gates allegedly lied repeatedly to the Justice Department and the FBI and caused their bookkeepers and lawyers to lie up to and including January 2017 about the fact of this lobbying and the sources of the funds that they moved. $75 million total, about $18 million that Manafort allegedly laundered illegally, and about $3 million that Rick Gates moved through accounts here in the
U.S. Rick Gates, again, a Manafort's kind of business guy. But Gates stayed on the campaign after Manafort left, then until recently worked at a Trump-aligned political action committee. The president tweeted out after the news this morning, "Sorry, but this is years ago, before Paul Manafort was part of the Trump campaign." As you and I were just saying, actually some of it extends. He writes, the president writes, "Why aren't crooked Hillary and the Dems the focus?" And here's Kellyanne Conway on Fox before the charges and the guilty plea were revealed.
As the president has said, everybody's fully cooperating, and we'll let these investigations, there are three of them, one in the House, one in the Senate, one by Mr. Mueller and his very expansive large team of attorneys, going forward. But the president has also made very clear as recently as this weekend that he considers this a hoax.
The president and his allies did have like a Twitter storm over the weekend trying to deflect attention and say this investigation is a hoax. Why not? Something should be done now about Hillary Clinton. But what is the buzz in Washington, Carrie, about this?
Well, the guilty plea today of George Papadopoulos, one of President Trump's foreign policy advisors, suggests that neither George Papadopoulos nor special counsel Robert Mueller view this investigation as a hoax. And there are numerous avenues available to investigators moving forward, both in the special counsel's office and in the House and the Senate side, with respect to who Papadopoulos was communicating with about his contacts with Russia last year during the campaign. This is far from over. In fact, it's only just begun.
Carrie Johnson, NPR's Justice Department correspondent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, aside from the news about the indictments in the Russia probe, Congress also continues its own investigations into Russian meddling in the election. There are three congressional hearings scheduled this week on the role social media and big tech played. The Senate Judiciary Committee's panel on crime and terrorism holds its hearing tomorrow afternoon, with lawyers representing Google, Facebook, and Twitter scheduled to testify. The Senate and House Intelligence Committees hold similar hearings on Wednesday. Phil Ewing is NPR National Security Editor. He joins us now to talk about these hearings. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
And what are these hearings going to look at specifically with regard to social media and tech companies?
Well, there were basically two sides to this Russian effort to try to influence the presidential election last year. One was the clandestine side, the covert side that we hear a lot about, involving cyber attacks and the attempt to extract information from political targets or state voting records. And then there was the overt side, which used heavily these social media platforms. Russian influence mongers used fake accounts to try to organize events in the real world. They bought a lot of ads that targeted divisive social issues in the United States. And what members of Congress want these big tech companies to talk about is, what happened? When did you become aware that this was happening? And what steps can we in Congress take, and can you, the big tech world, take to keep it from happening again?
And in looking at this issue, you write that what happened last year is not new, in a sense, because Russia has been trying to meddle in U.S. politics for decades, long before there even was social media.
Yeah, that's correct. And the attempt by nations to influence each other's internal workings is as old as statecraft. So that especially is certainly not new. And the use by what intelligence officers called active measures has also been taking place in the United States throughout the Cold War. And there are examples that go back to the 60s, to the KGB targeting the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, that provide a through line that you can draw right till today with these ads that, for example, Russian-linked accounts bought on Facebook that targeted black activists in the United States, from whether they be Black Lives Matters or others. And this is something that policymakers in Washington have struggled with all along, because the Russian government and its fellow travelers are not subject to U.S. law. And so there's not really very much that Congress can do with its own remit domestically to clamp down on those types of activities.
Well, what were the Russians or the Soviets during the Cold War trying to accomplish with those actions?
They wanted to do many of the same things that they've attempted to do more recently. They wanted to create political conditions in the United States or in Europe that were favorable to them, that accentuated controversy, that didn't invent issues like the peace movement or the anti-nuclear movement, but turn it into something that would benefit them by putting pressure on policymakers internally, whether in the United States or Europe, that would bring about a result that was desirable from the Russian perspective.
So back to these hearings that are going on Capitol Hill this week, are they expected to set the stage for any action by Congress?
Well, that's the big question here. This is going to be an example of two sides on either side of the witness table kind of assessing how strong the cards they're holding are. Members of Congress want a new law that, for example, in one case, would mandate more transparency by social platforms, your Facebooks and your Twitters, is to show who was buying ads, whether they were foreign, what they were paying, what messages were in those ads and who they were targeting. And the social media companies don't want any law or any restriction. They want to be able to do this themselves. And they've already announced some changes in the way that they're going to use their policies going forward. So the question will be, will members of Congress say, okay, big tech, you can regulate yourselves going forward? Or will they say, no, no matter what comes out of this, we, members of Congress, will pass a bill that mandates the way you can behave and mandates the way you run your businesses? That's what everyone's going to be looking forward to.
And are you expecting these tech companies to be careful with their words as they testify on Capitol Hill?
I expect them to be very careful. I think they're not going to want to make any news. They're not going to want to be any TV-friendly sound bites with members of Congress. Mm. They want to indicate how much they want to play ball and, you know, keep this quiet as they can.
That's Phil Ewing, NPR's national security editor. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
It's here and now. I was dreaming when I wrote this. Forgive me if it goes astray. But when I woke up this morning, could have sworn it was Judgment Day. It has been a year and a half since Prince died from a fentanyl overdose at the age of 57. He left an indelible imprint on music and on American culture, pushing the boundaries of music and sexuality and influencing countless musicians and fans. One person who had a front-row seat to Prince's life and career is Afshin Shahidi. He was Prince's longtime photographer and has a book of his photographs just out. It's called Prince, A Private View. Afshin Shahidi joins us now, and you write about the zone you were in when you were photographing Prince. What was it like?
Well, part of what was exciting shooting Prince was also the challenging part, which was the fact that we had nobody else there. He liked to keep it small and intimate, and so I respected that, and so I didn't have any support really. So it was just him and I, and there was a little bit of discussion at first. I'd tell him what I was thinking, what I'd like to do, and I would show him a couple of test shots, and he would hit a zone, and it was magical. It wasn't so much that I wanted to stay quiet, but he was in a zone that just worked for him, and he would come, and I didn't have to direct him. He had already picked out, based on what I said the background's going to be or the image, he had already picked out wardrobe that always ended up being perfect and had done a little bit of makeup and came in. And literally a lot of the portraits in there that you see, I shot maybe two or three images, and then we went on and did the next thing. So,
and just to give people a sense of what a photographer would normally do, how many would you usually shoot if it weren't Prince?
I would probably shoot close to 100.
Wow.
You know, and part of it was he knew what he wanted out of the images. I knew when we had a great image, you know, I had an iconic subject, so it was really difficult to take a bad picture of him. But we didn't need to be redundant. If I had it, I didn't need to do another one the same with a slightly different, you know, pose. So we would take advantage of that time, and you know, I would show it to him. He's like, wow, that's great. And then he would go and put on something completely different, and I'd change the lighting a little bit, and we'd have a new image.
Some of the close-up photos of Prince in your book are posed with his eyes as the focal point. What was it about Prince's eyes that you think were so striking?
His eyes were piercing, and they always seemed to be looking through you and to know so much about you. And I remember even before I was photographing him or even knew him, but as a child growing up, seeing images of him and watching Purple Rain and stuff, there was always something about his eyes that seemed special. And so when I got to photograph him, they became the focal point. And they are really of a lot of subjects. I mean, you see a lot in people's eyes, and that's where you focus your camera. You know, when someone's eyes are out of focus, that's typically when a photograph looks out of focus. So it's always the focal point anyway. But his gaze was just so piercing that it kind of drew me to it.
You also write about the fact that when Prince walks into a room, the energy shifts. I wonder if that has to do with his eyes, but it also just his presence, it sounds like.
I think mostly his presence. And like I said, in there you could be a CEO of a company, or I've seen Tom Cruise and Jennifer Lopez in a room, and the second prince walks in, they're little fans. So it's pretty interesting to watch. I mean, obviously he has kept an aura of mystery around himself. You didn't see Prince out all that often, so when you did see him, it was a special moment.
You have some pictures of him walking the streets in different cities around the world, which is an image that we don't really see. What was it like for him? And you took those photos. What was it like to be out in the streets? Did people recognize him everywhere he went?
People didn't recognize him, funny enough, and I think partly because no one expected Prince to be walking. So if anyone even did see him and think he looked familiar, they may have thought, oh, that's a Prince impersonator or someone that really looks like Prince, because it was just so unexpected. Now, my presence and the camera may have tipped it off, but even when I was taking those images, I tried to stay far away from him, so we weren't necessarily connected. And it was something special for him because he didn't really do it. So when we were in New York City and I asked him to take about a two-block walk from a hotel to a venue and he agreed, at the end of it, I think he really enjoyed himself because he wasn't mobbed. It was just him and I, no bodyguards. And we got to the venue and he's like, thank you, Afshin, because I don't think that was something that he got to do all that often.
What was your favorite shot as you were going through all of these photos of Prince to put this book together?
That's hard. I can tell you one shot that I think he really liked is a shot of him that I took when he was shooting the Black Sweat music video. It's a portrait. He has a black hat on, I think a black coat, and he's looking directly into camera. And I think for whatever reason that resonated with him a lot. I think it showed him as the mature artist that he was and he became. One of my favorite photos, again, was one of the images that I had a millisecond to shoot and only two opportunities at. And it's him in London at the Dorchester Hotel. He's standing on a mirrored spiral staircase looking up. And I took two shots, and that was one of them. And that's all the time he gave me because we were running out to, again, go to a venue. I think he had either the sound check or the performance that evening.
You also write about the fact that you had many nights, late nights in his hotel room. Maybe he had other people there, and sometimes it was just the two of you. And he would talk about being a Jehovah's Witness. Do you think he was trying to convert you?
I think part of being Jehovah's Witness is converting, is teaching other people about your beliefs. So I was not the only one, and so he did tell me about his beliefs in Jehovah's Witness, but it never felt, and I never felt, that it was any pressure. Along with Jehovah's Witness, we talked about a lot of different things. So I think he liked informing people, he liked teaching people, and those were his beliefs at that time, and that's what he was trying to convey. But I was flattered that he cared enough about me to want to convert me. You know, when I told him I had my own beliefs, he respected that, and we went on and continued working together with no issues.
Why did you stop working with Prince when you did?
There was a couple things. One, I had moved to Los Angeles. I had three children. A lot of the travel was becoming difficult. I also had a career as a cinematographer, and for quite a while I had kind of pushed it aside because I was doing so much with Prince and traveling so much. So I had decided to be home more. That was part of it. Two, a lot of the photos that I was taking of Prince were ending up on his music club. He had an online presence, and so most of the images were being serviced for that. And when he dismantled the music club, the need for so many images diminished. And then, again, when he would call occasionally, I was not available. I had already been booked. As you may have read in the book, there was not a lot of pre-planning in terms of scheduling.
So right, he would call you up and say, I'm in Panama, come down.
Yeah, exactly. He called me the night before and, can you come to Morocco or can you come to Panama or wherever it may have been? Can you come to Japan? It was very exciting. And, I laughed at the fact that it just became so normal that someone could just call and ask for that. And I'd say, sure, and get on a plane the next day. But it became more difficult. I should take that back. Not more difficult, but a lot of my priorities and in terms of having children and wanting to be around dictated what I decided to do and not to do.
Did you know about his drug addiction?
I was not aware of anything in regards
really?
To drugs. In the 20 years that I was with him, I did not see anything.
So what did you think when you heard about his death?
I was devastated. My whole family was. I know the world was. I felt bad for myself because I had lost a friend. I felt horrible for the world because they had lost an icon and an amazing voice that I think would have been really needed today in the political climate that we're in. So I was devastated. In terms of how he passed away, I'm just sad that he's gone. I don't have any strong feelings on it. I know he was in pain from years of heels and dancing and performing for the audiences, for his fans. But really, I made this book to celebrate his life and not his death so much.
So I am not by no means the biggest Prince fan in the world, but I did see him at Madison Square Garden. And the day that he died, I flew to New York and went to a special show that Questlove was doing where he spun Prince all night long. And it was such a sort of bittersweet moment because you were listening to this incredible music. And at the same time, he had just died. What do you think about the impact that Prince had on people all around the world?
Well, he had an enormous impact. I mean, for so many of us, he was kind of the soundtrack of our lives and we grew up with him. I can tell you personally that fans from all over the world have reached out. Part of the reason I made this book was because they reached out and said, you know, he was such a huge part of my life and we know you have these images and please, it'll help us with the healing process and with the mourning process. So for me, the book was therapy and hopefully something that helps everyone else out there. But he had an enormous impact, both musically as an artist standing up for his rights and showing other artists how to do that. So I don't know if I could put into words really what an influence he was and what a great loss it is that he's gone.
That's Afshin Shahidi, who is a photographer and cinematographer and author of the new book, Prince, A Private View. Afshin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
And you can see a couple of the photos from the book at hereandnow.org.
And Halloween is tomorrow, which is why there's half a witch sticking out of your neighbor's house. In fact, you might have noticed more house decorations. Halloween sales look to be up about 8% from last year to just over $9 billion. And it's not just house decorations, it's costumes, cards, candy. This means that there could be a strong holiday shopping season as well. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax joins us. She's been taking a look at this. Marilyn, this is the latest of many reports in recent years pointing to this, you know, economic impact of Halloween. We can see it for ourselves with our own eyes. What are economists saying?
Well, it's not just for kids anymore. The National Retail Federation says they've surveyed more than 7,000 consumers, and about 3 out of 4 Americans will do something for Halloween. Even if you don't have kids, you probably are throwing a bag of those mini candy bars into your basket when you're going through the store. So all of that adds up, and the trade group says that there probably will be about $2.7 billion in spending on Halloween candy. And then we spend another $3 billion on things like those decorations, the greeting cards, the napkins. And the biggest category, though, is the $3.4 billion that we spend on costumes. So you add it all up, it's more than $9 billion. And that's impressive when you consider that this isn't reflecting higher prices on the items, because actually, you know, some of those prices have fallen.
Oh, well, retail prices falling?
To me, that's kind of the interesting thing when I look at these numbers. Sales are actually really going up. We're buying more items because the prices themselves are down a little bit. We've had record production of cocoa and, you know, these forecasting firms like IHS Market. They looked at it and they said Halloween candy prices are down nearly 1% this year. So you have also the CPI is showing that apparel costs are down. So that might include maybe your apparel is a ghost costume. But in any case, these prices are down a little bit. So we're really buying more stuff. And part of the reason, too, for the prices being down is just that there's so much intense competition. You know, those pop-up stores for Halloween, the discounters, the online. So all of it comes together to create pretty cheap products, but we want a lot of them.
Well, and why are we spending so much? I don't want you to psychoanalyze this, but, you know, analyze it through the economic point of view. The Federal Reserve reports that outstanding credit card debt hit a record $1 trillion this year, and yet people splurging on Halloween.
Yeah, because it seems like what's happening there is we've got those solid hiring gains. There have also been some bigger raises this year. And then there's kind of this general feeling that home prices are rising and the stock market's rising. So maybe that makes your retirement account look better. So the University of Michigan, they do this survey of consumers, and they found in October it was really surging confidence among consumers. So overall, it looks like that creates a lot of momentum for shopping moving into the holiday season as well. So November and December look like they might be quite positive.
You know, it could just be that the political climate has been just so toxic and we've had all these terrible weather events. Maybe people just want to be silly and crazy and put a costume on. What are the biggest sellers?
Well, it's the action figures, the superheroes and princesses. So maybe there is a good bit of wanting to escape reality and put those big fake muscles on and your princess costume. It's good to be Batman and Wonder Woman.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn G. Wax. Marilyn, thanks as always.
Oh, you're welcome.
Happy Halloween.
And same to you, Robin.
It has been 5 years since Hurricane Sandy slammed into the East Coast. The storm caused 182 deaths in the Caribbean and the United States and more than $65 billion of damage in the U.S. In New York City alone, Sandy caused 43 deaths and $19 billion of damage. In New York and New Jersey, there was devastating flooding. In Lower Manhattan, a power outage that lasted several days. Sandy also made landfall at high tide, creating a storm surge of 14 feet in Battery Park at the southern tip of Manhattan and in Staten Island, and 11 feet on the Coney Island Peninsula. After the storm, many experts pointed out that New York will end up spending more money on the damage than it would have if it had pumped billions into new infrastructure to protect against the storm surge. So what has the city done in the 5 years since to try to prevent the kind of damage Sandy caused? Joining us now from New York is Bill Golden, who's the president of the National Institute for Coastal and Harbor Infrastructure. Bill, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And if Superstorm Sandy were to hit again, would it be different, let's just say, in New York City? Has the city made infrastructure changes to prevent that level of damage?
Well, it's not a question of if. It's really when the next Sandy will hit. And if the next Sandy was to hit today, the damage would be much the same as it was 5 years ago. And that's because we have not yet learned the lesson of Sandy. And that's that we're facing a new reality that has resulted from climate change-induced storm surge and sea level rise.
Well, what should have been done?
We have to recognize that the new reality of storm surge and sea level rise requires a response based on three fundamental principles. The first is that these storms are not local storms. They're regional in nature. They don't stop at political boundaries and have to be addressed on a regional planned basis. The second is that we have to differentiate between storm surge and sea level rise. They're two very different phenomena. Storm surge is an episodic event, such as Superstorm Sandy, that when combined with increased levels of tidal action, as is coming from sea level rise, can have devastating episodic effects on communities, particularly urban areas, while sea level rise is a gradual, more predictable phenomenon that requires a much more comprehensive approach, but a much less intensive approach. And the third thing is that we're dealing with really two realities. Just as when Sandy hit, there were people fighting for their lives and losing their lives on Staten Island, when in Times Square, there were people posing with Mickey Mouse. And until you go through a Sandy and experience it, it is very difficult to have a full appreciation of the impact of this new reality we're facing and the need for comprehensive solutions to sea level rise and storm surge.
I was in Manhattan during Sandy, and I couldn't believe that from 39th Street and below, there was no power for several days. There was, you know, flooding along the water. There were cars that were brought out into the middle of the streets in Manhattan from the flooding. But I know that one thing that's being talked about is called the Big U. Tell us what that is.
There are two approaches to hardening an area to protect it from storm surge and sea level rise. The first is an offshore barrier meant to protect a large area in a comprehensive way by shortening the coastline. That's a concept the Dutch have used for hundreds of years. And by doing that, you can build a 25, 30-foot wall over a six-mile stretch that protects 820 miles of coastline in the greater New York, New Jersey metropolitan area. The other alternative is called a perimeter defense, where you actually build a wall on the edge of the water in a city. Now, if that wall is intended to keep out sea level rise, over the next 50 years, it might be 3 feet high. Over the next 100 years, it might be 6 feet high. But if that wall is intended to keep out both storm surge and sea level rise, it has to be 20 or 25 feet high.
Hmm.
Now, the Big U proposed a concept where you would build that kind of wall that had an elevation at its top of 20 or 25 feet around a densely urban area, lower Manhattan. Again, something that has never been done. So in structuring this wall, you have all kinds of issues that have arisen.
Well, and starting with cost, right? I mean, this is not a cheap project to do either one of these, the wall out in the sea or the wall on the land.
No, the cost is definitely significant for protecting an urban area from storm surge and sea level rise in terms of the cost of the construction of the infrastructure. But it is a bargain when you consider that a regional storm surge barrier could protect the city for 100 years or more, and then the next Sandy would cost the city probably $25 or $30 billion, more than the construction of a regional storm surge barrier. So by constructing a regional storm surge barrier, which is the cost of approximately what Sandy was in 2012, by the way, Mayor Bloomberg calculated the cost of Sandy in mid-century would be $90 billion.
Hmm.
And the National Academy of Sciences has said that the 500-year storm can be expected as frequently as every 25 years. So if you are building a regional storm surge barrier that can protect the city for 100 years, you are protecting it from four or more Sandy-type events. And that means that that storm surge barrier has paid for itself many times over.
So why hasn't construction started on a storm surge barrier then?
Well, that's a very good question. A construction on a storm surge barrier has not been done in New York City, even though such barriers are in use and have been for decades all over Europe, in London, in Rotterdam, in St. Petersburg, and now in Venice, and are being built in Asia and in this country, have existed for decades in New Bedford, Providence, and Stamford. And recently, a barrier the size of what we're talking about was just completed in 4.5 years in Louisiana. And another one's now being planned for Galveston, Houston. But there hasn't been a focus on the local level to build a storm surge barrier. The concept was that we should respond on a local level to build projects that can be built quickly without cooperation by the state government. This concept was deeply flawed. Again, local barriers don't protect you from regional impacts. Local barriers that try to protect you from both sea level rise and storm surge are not only expensive, they are almost impossible to build in a densely urban environment and are not effective.
So what do you think will happen?
I think what will happen is that some of these projects will be built locally. And that's okay. It's good to have a layered defense. In fact, we advocate a layered defense where you have a regional storm surge barrier that protects you from 25 to 30-foot surges and local seawalls that protect you from 3 to 6 feet of sea level rise. That kind of layered defense on a regional basis makes sense. Many of the projects that are planned now that are intended to protect lower Manhattan and the region from storm surge simply will not get built. And this is clear from the experience of Hoboken. Hoboken was awarded through Rebuild by Design the little U. And the intent was to do for Hoboken what New York City is trying to do for New York City, for lower Manhattan, to build a wall around Hoboken. Well, Hoboken has moved forward faster than New York. And the results are really the canary in the mine, the warning to the big U. In trying to build this wall, the wall was so strongly opposed by the community. People just didn't want to have a 20-foot wall between them and the water for many different reasons, that wall was moved back into the center of the city, leaving 20% of the city, the most vulnerable part of the city, exposed, and also leaving the whole rail yard and interconnection exposed. So that phenomenon, I think, is indicative of what will happen in New York City when New York City finally gets to the design stage. There is no final design, so there's nothing for the residents of New York or the businesses in New York to really respond to yet. And that's 5 years after Sandy.
That's Bill Golden, who is the president of the National Institute for Coastal and Harbor Infrastructure, talking with us about what's happened in the New York, New Jersey area 5 years after Sandy. Bill Golden, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Glacier Bay National Park in southeast Alaska is home to some of the oldest ecological records in the world, a natural laboratory for scientists studying the effects of glacial change. But the locations of some of the groundbreaking research plots from 100 years ago were lost. So an ecologist in Juneau went on the adventure of a lifetime to locate the plots in an effort to find clues about how glaciers retreat. Elizabeth Jenkins of Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
When botanist William S. Cooper arrived in Glacier Bay in 1916, he did so in a large, comfortable research vessel. But a century later, Brian Buma's transportation around the inlet was a little more modest. Buma led three scientists along the coastline this summer in kayaks.
And right now, there's a mother bear and three cubs on the shore. Right where we want to land. They're eating strawberries and intertidal goodies. So we're going to wait a second.
Buma is an ecology professor at the University of Alaska Southeast. And William S. Cooper, the godfather of modern ecology, is one of the two characters who have influenced his academic pursuits. The other is referenced in Buma's yellow notebook, the one he takes out with him in the field. On the inside, it says,
"To the Canyon of the Crescent Moon."
A nod to Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, where Indy searches for the Holy Grail. And in some ways, Buma would embark on his own journey, looking for his version of buried treasure. He set out to find Cooper's lost research plots in Glacier Bay. Cooper's research began over 100 years ago, when he traveled from his home in Minnesota to Alaska. He wanted to see how the landscape was adapting to glacial melt, and that meant returning to the same spots over time to see how the vegetation changed. By the 1930s, Cooper had stopped coming to the area.
So we have all this really interesting and really exciting studies that he did, but then a big gap. And so I thought it might be just possible to retrace his steps.
To pinpoint the exact locations in Glacier Bay, Buma flew to the University of Minnesota last year and looked through Cooper's journals for clues. He found exhaustive notes, photographs, and sketches about where the plots could be found. But finding Cooper's spots would still prove to be a challenge.
He did a lot of distance in paces, which is not generally a standard unit of measurement. And so, frankly, it on paper, it looks pretty easy. And then when you get out there, it turns out to be very, very, very difficult.
Buma would have to navigate through a different landscape than in Cooper's day. In the early 1900s, there was lots of exposed rock. Glaciers had recently retreated from the plots, but there was still more ice visible. Today, the surroundings are largely a tangle of shrubs and trees.
It's like trying to push through a jungle gym. Like, they just don't give. And so you're constantly contorting yourself to, slope yourself sideways or get yourself diagonal, and you got a backpack and you got a metal detector and you got bear spray.
Tall epilobium. Hey, bear! That's Bear Trail here. Suppose they know where they're going. So we're walking to Q1.
Yuma and his team have visited Glacier Bay for the past two summers. After bushwhacking for hours, sometimes days, they would get an inkling they were in the right location. Maybe it came from Cooper's old black and white photographs, or the compass bearings retooled for today's magnetic north. In any case, that's when they would bring out the metal detector and scan the ground for old nails.
The markers are all buried. They weren't buried when you put them in, of course, but they're all buried now under the developing soil.
You're thinking, wow, this is amazing. You know, no one's been here in a really long time. This is the spot that I read about as an undergrad.
And that sounds good.
It took Buma about a week in 2016 to locate all eight of Cooper's plots in Glacier Bay. And this summer, after cataloging the species of plants in the area, his team did something not possible back in Cooper's day. They took a nitrogen sample from the soil, with the hopes that scientists can better understand how vegetation grows in a place that used to be covered in ice.
Well, all that information will make us better modelers of climate change in the future.
Buma says observations like Cooper's are rare. Most climate change research didn't start until decades later. So this kind of record can help tell us where the future is headed as more of the world's glaciers retreat. It's unclear if Cooper knew that warming would become a threat over 100 years ago. But Buma says he did know that people could have an impact on the environment. Cooper even lobbied Congress to protect Glacier Bay as a national park.
And it makes him prescient in a sense. I mean, even in his very first paper saying the value of this study, and this is almost word for word, if not word for word, the value of this study will only increase with time. So I'm leaving directions so that it can continue after I'm gone.
And Brian Buma says Cooper was right. The value has increased. So he plans to return to Glacier Bay to help track the growth of this new environment for the rest of his life. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And of course, we're following the top story today, indictments given out from the special counsel's investigation into potential ties between the Trump campaign and Russia in the 2016 election. We will keep you up to date throughout the day, of course, this afternoon on All Things Considered. Stay tuned. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.